We're really good at making the rules, but we are really good at breaking the rules with the right incentives. And machines don't necessarily have that in them. And of course, we have to figure sometimes you want a human touch in the interaction. In other cases, you definitely don't want any humans involved, and we have to make those types of choices. So there's a framework where you engage humans and place humans in charge, but there's also logistical and reality of the volume and the size and the complexity are at machine scale now. And that's where you're going to actually use machine scale AI versus human.
Welcome to Stay Cognizant, our podcast about the people, ideas, and technology that will help you get ahead and stay ahead. I'm Pamela Axtell. Hello, and welcome to Stay Cognizant. We are really excited today to have two guests who are true thought leaders in the artificial intelligence and specifically the Gen AI space, Ray Wong and Babak Hojat. Babak is a serial entrepreneur. He's a true pioneer in the field of artificial intelligence. Babak co-founded Sentient Technologies. He founded the first AI-driven hedge fund. One of my favorite things that I like to tell people about Babak is that he is one of the primary inventors of the technology that powers Apple's Siri. It even makes me cool with my 18-year-old son to say that. And now Babak is the chief technology officer of AI at Cognizant and truly a thought leader, both in and outside of Cognizant in AI, natural language processing, and machine learning. Babak, it's always a thrill to speak with you. Really appreciate your time today. Before we dive into our conversation today, can you just share a little bit about, you know, what does it mean to be CTO of AI at a company like Cognizant?
Yes, thank you. We run the AI R&D for Cognizant. It's actually quite special to be in a position to be able to push the boundaries on the state of the art in AI through core AI research. Our labs are actually measured by the number of peer-reviewed academic papers that we publish, the number of patents that we get issued, that we invent. And at the same time, there is a cohering principle around what we do, which is take the best of the inventions that are coming out of research and build them into various different accelerators and platforms and client engagements. So, for those of us who've been in AI and have wanted to bring AI and its practical applications to the world, this is the best place to be. And so that's basically what I do. It's really, really fun.
Ray Wang is the founder, chairman, and principal analyst at Constellation Research. Ray is also a renowned author. He's written best-selling books, Disrupting Digital Business, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. Ray is a leading authority on AI, digital transformation, and the future of business. And I wonder, Ray, can you put that into layman speak for us? What does a typical day or week look like for you?
We spend a lot of time with a network of CXOs thinking about how to improve their businesses. And a big part of it's really been the digitization. And now it's really about thinking how we can use AI to improve decisions, making faster decisions, making better decisions along the way. And that's still part of that journey as people are trying to take exponential technologies and apply them to their business to get an advantage.
So you gave me a great lead into our conversation today, which is going to be a deeper dive into decision intelligence. And I wonder if before we dive in, maybe each of you can share, you know, sort of your thinking about how you frame what decision intelligence is and why it's going to be really such a potent force for enterprises.
One thing that I think is obvious is all data and AI and analytics at the end of the day is in the service of someone somewhere making a decision. It's useless in isolation, obviously. Typically, we as humans have thought of the decision-making part of this as our exclusive realm. So give me the insights and then I know what to do, which is cool and has got us pretty far. But making decisions is very, very difficult. You're making decisions with incomplete data. You have to look at many, many different facets. Yes, you might pull from your experience and intuition, but you know, how do you know if it's always right? There might be circumstances that you haven't experienced before. Also, oftentimes, almost always, we're making decisions optimizing against more than one outcome, more than one KPI at the same time. And those KPI are not aligned. Like, you know, when you think of a business, you're optimizing for revenue while you want to minimize cost, while possibly you want to be ethical about how you operate in the world, and you might have a greater goal as well. And so these might be in conflict. And so there's no best decision. There's a balance of best decision given all the KPI. And it's not very easy to do that. So decision intelligence is this science and technology that helps you make those decisions, gives you very specific recommendations and predictions of outcomes. If you do this, here's what's going to happen, and here's what we recommend you do. And AI can help augment human decision making and make it more impactful.
Yeah, what he said. No, I'm just kidding. We'll jump in different.
What can you add to that?
Well, it's very hard to add to that. But actually, if you think about this, so we've gone from augmenting our capabilities to accelerating capabilities to the point where we're now looking at agents. And ultimately, we're going to get to like automation, agents, and then advisors. But in each of these steps, what we're really trying to figure out is, you know, how you actually accelerate a concept we call decision velocity. You and I make a snap decision, but it takes us what? A day to get out of management committee, a month, a quarter, maybe never. And that's the challenge, right? Because we're not making decisions quickly enough, especially very, very small decisions, which all add up. And now over time, what's going to happen is different places where AIs actually play a role, we actually have to figure out where humans are actually in the loop. And so decisions are going to be automated, but at some point, where does the human actually interject themselves into that process? And so a lot of this conversation on AI has been this, you know, conversation about where do we automate. We actually think it's a little bit different, because if you start thinking about decisions, then the question you have to ask is, when and where do you insert a human? Because that becomes the linchpin as to being able to figure out what slows down the process, what has human judgment, how we continue to learn from it. And so if you do a decision tree map over time, you'll start to see certain things get automated over time, but here's a crux pin where actually a human has to step and intervene. So for example, is it a life and death decision? Is it something that's not, doesn't have clear regulatory requirements? Is it something that requires a judgment call, right? That's where it gets interesting. And so once we move to that point, this whole notion of decision intelligence and decision automation becomes very interesting, because now you have to layer things like, whoa, what would a human do? What would a machine do? And so the ultimate example here is, and you've probably heard something like this, it's 2050. We are flying from San Francisco to New York. Somewhere 100 miles away from New York, a bird strike occurs. You know, it's an automated jet. And so there's no pilot, right? You've got 120 people on the plane. You've got 10 million people on the ground. What do we do? Well, all logic says is, yeah, you probably would abort the plane and crash it to save 10 million people on the ground. That would be the logical decision. But who says that's the logical decision? Because there's this one exception where a guy named Captain Scully decided that he'd land a plane on the Hudson. So there's a 0.007% chance that you can do that. What's the prompt that shows up from the plane? Would you like to renew your insurance policy? Right? So which, you know, now as a human, like every time I would probably say, you know, I will take control. I will take the risk on that insurance policy any day because I'm a human. The machine would actually counter and say, no, that's not where you would go. But that's a place where you would have human decision making pop up. Right. So that decision automation and decision intelligence is there for us to actually ultimately make the decision. Now, the other way to flip it around when you want thinking about when and where do you insert a human, you also have to have ask the question, who do you sue when something goes wrong? Because then you know exactly where you put the human. Is it the operator of the jet? Is it the software manufacturer who came up with the prompt? Or is it the insurance agency? Or do you sue the government? And that kind of clarity is going to be so important as we think about the outcomes of AI.
So there's so much to unpack in there, and we'll certainly talk a little bit about ethics and some of the things you brought up later. But I think one of the clear themes as you're talking through this, I think, is change management, right? It's like, how do we, you know, think about a world where there is a pilotless plane, or there are these other things that are not currently part of the way that we as humans think about engaging in the world? And I'm wondering, Babak, you know, what do you see as some of the biggest challenges that companies are, you know, facing, maybe already, you already know, you know, in conversation with some of our clients, or even projecting, you know, as this continues to accelerate, what are going to be the challenges that companies are going to face in adopting this? And, you know, maybe particularly, I would think that, you know, even with an example like Raise, you're going to have a whole new approach to tracking outcomes and really understanding how the human should intervene. So what, maybe you can reflect a little bit on what you see there.
Yeah. And by the way, I violently agree with everything Ray said. One thing to add, I mean, when Ray says decision velocity is important, it's tantamount. And the reason for that is that the sooner you can actually absorb the latest data that's coming out and take it into consideration into your decision making, the better you can make decisions. So very, very important. And at these high frequencies, humans simply can't operate. So we do need, you know, the machine to step in and help. To your question of challenges, that is one of the challenges. Like, what is the data that needs to be collected to help the machine help us with the decision making? And oftentimes that data is not collected. Even in companies that are collecting tons and tons of data, they might not be collecting the correct data, or they're not collecting the consequences of decisions that they made before that help us fine-tune the AI in making the decisions. So there's a data moat that we have to get over. And the only way to do that is to, in my opinion, to actually build these decision augmentation systems as the harness that collects the data as well. Where data is missing, you can actually have, for example, reasoning and common sense of these large language models to help as well. So it's not the end of the world if there's some data that you're not collecting. So that's one. Another is a cultural aspect. Which is, you know, we've always been the prime decision makers in these situations. How do we trust the system? Well, you won't know until you actually start observing the recommendations that the system gives you and experiencing the quality of those decisions and gradually trusting that. So that's part of the trust. The other part of the trust is the fact that we all know the state of the art in AI, especially neural networks, these are opaque and unexplainable, decision-making systems, right? Mm-hmm. And so the AI needs to take steps to garner that trust. Part of that is explainability. Part of that is being able to tell when it's not certain. So being able to say, hey, here's the recommendation I'm giving you, but I'm less certain about this recommendation, maybe because it's more unfamiliar territory for me. And so there's a lot on the features, but also the user experience that provides that trust, you know, or garners that trust from the users. So that the adoption gets picked up. So those are some of the challenges that we face. I would say the first and foremost, though, is just the culture not being ready to accept an AI to come in and help with that decision augmentation. So it's not even on the list of things that people are looking for, oftentimes.
So, you know, staying with culture for a moment, you know, at Cognizant, we've spent quite a bit of time since, I think, the middle of last year, really thinking about cultural change, workforce change, skilling, and, you know, really how humans who are in the loop and are engaging with AI are going to have to upgrade, up-level their skills or change, you know, the way that they think about the work that they do. And Ray, I'm wondering, you know, as we talk about this, you know, decision velocity and really changing the way that we think about our role, what are the skills and knowledge areas that are gaps that, you know, the workforce of the future are going to need to really be able to take advantage of that? And how do you think companies can support that? You know, I'm guessing it's not part of the typical training, you know, and development that a lot of enterprises have today. So how do you see that evolving to really take advantage of this new way of leveraging AI?
It's a great point. I mean, to Babak's point is the trust factor is going to be very important. And so one of the things that employees need to develop is really understanding context and understanding how their decision making has an upstream and a downstream impact. And let me give you some examples. So a lot of folks might think that there's a certain pattern that's there and they make decisions in a certain way. But once they can see how they make their own decisions and what the impact is to the system, that's when you can actually realize, if you're missing a pattern or if you're not trusting a pattern, what you have to do. So, for example, you may only see the world from your location, a certain time of day, and of course, working with a certain set of coworkers. And you may come to a belief that the actions that you take are always correct. But until you stand in someone else's position on a different location at a different night shift, maybe, and actually, with a different set of coworkers, you won't understand why those decisions are being made. And so part of the ability to actually do observability, to do the tracking, to show people what's going on helps to build that trust. And so we have to get really good at trying to understand the context of a scenario and how it gets applied to a different scenario. And so that's a very difficult skill for some employees to learn because they don't always get to sit in someone's shoes. The second piece of it is really understanding when we're actually augmenting someone. And there's going to be two areas where we're actually going to have to get really big improvements in skills and knowledge, which is augmenting a machine with a human. And that's where we actually break things. Why do people make exceptions? Why are there false positives and false negatives? How come people take different types of pathways that are not in the traditional pathways? And by understanding that nuance, we can actually improve our precision. You might say, hey, look, right now we're 85% accurate with our LLM and our automation process. And someone might think that's good, might be okay, but 85% accuracy is not really good if you're talking about supply chain, because you could be losing $1 million a minute by making your manufacturing plants idle. 85% accuracy in finance is definitely not good because someone's going to go to jail. 85% accuracy in healthcare? Okay, now we realize how silly this is. Right. And so it's getting to that comfort level of where the automation is going to happen and then understanding when actually the human actually has to be placed into it, because there's going to be a lot of times we make those exceptions. Now, in other cases where automation allows us, in customer experience, to know what a customer bought, understand were they happy in their last interaction, what's the tone of their voice, right? That's different. We're just augmenting the human with more data points so that they can do a better job and they start building trust with those systems, knowing that, hey, this is going to be fun. So it takes time for everybody to operate at machine scale with humans, because we do have to find points to slow things down. So a great example is, the market goes crazy, the stock market crashes like 2-3%, automatic trading curbs, right? The market stops, everybody slows down, people reset their algorithms, humans try to figure out what's going on, and then we restart the markets again. And so we're going to see stuff like that pop up. And so when we think about what that type of training and the skills and knowledge, it's really trying to see the larger picture, understand the decision tree and the flow, and more importantly, being comfortable understanding what the implications of an action is, both on the upstream side and the downstream side. And companies can support this development by helping to build out those decision trees and decision maps, and also letting people test and simulate what the impact is based on their types of decisions and reactions.
So I want to stay on people for a minute, Ray. And, you wrote an article earlier this year for Destination CRM. It was called The AI Endgame is Decision Automation. And in it, you shared 5 questions that you suggest enterprises ask themselves to test their readiness to, do a lot of the things that you've been talking about. And, one of your questions was really about what points in the decision-making process is human intervention crucial, and what factors determine those points. Can you, just reflect on a little bit? How do you help companies think about that, given everything that you were just talking about the skill sets that are required in the context and, really being able to think about more than just the decision I'm making in the moment? How do you then also help companies think about, reflect back on, almost looking, dispassionately or objectively at the decision-making process, right, to understand when human intervention may not be as crucial? How do you help companies think about that?
Yeah, I think the important thing from that article is the fact that These systems have to be trusted by humans. And if they're not trusted by humans, they won't be used, and people will try to sabotage these systems with the wrong data and the wrong information. And part of it is making sure you have enough data points and insight that come along, right? The five questions we ask are: one, where and when do you insert a human, which we kind of talked about. Can you operate at machine scale with humans, which is if machines are making thousands of decisions per second, humans might not be able to catch up. And as Babak said, it's at a different scale. So how do you harmonize human scale with machine scale? You have to put in curbs. You have to put in check-ins. Do you have enough data to get to precision decisions? And that was the point around the 85%, right? Because 85% accuracy isn't enough. And if you don't have enough data, who do you partner with, right? Do you need better weather information? Do you need better demand information? Do you need to know customer sentiment? So how do you actually partner for that last amount of data? And of course, who do you put responsible when something goes wrong? And these are all human kind of questions that are being asked, because that's when humans do get involved. But when we think about tasks where they're going to be massively automated, back to the scale question Babak was talking about, lots of volume. We can't handle lots of volume. Massive nodes of interaction where we can maybe, I don't know, I can do three things at once. I can do five things at once, multitask. Mm-hmm. I can't do 3,000 things at once, right? That type of scale is not possible. And then when you talk about things that are highly complex, which get modeled in math, we're not really, really good at that. But a lot of decisions don't get modeled in math. And those are things we still haven't figured out how to build algorithms for. And that's where the human intervention comes into play. Creativity, that's another great one, right? We're really good at making the rules, but we are really good at breaking the rules with the right incentives. And machines don't necessarily really have that in them. And of course, we have to figure sometimes you want a human touch in the interaction. In other cases, you know, you definitely don't want any humans involved, and we have to make those types of choices. So there's a framework where you engage humans and place humans in charge, but there's also the logistical and reality of, you know, the volume and the size and the complexity are at machine scale now. And that's where you're going to actually use machine scale AI versus human.
So Babak, I want to shift gears a little bit now and talk about what's happening in the real world with our clients. I've seen you on stage a couple of times this year in less than 15 minutes. You know, you're interacting with a customer who's in the audience and building a use case in a multi-agent environment to, you know, kind of help true out, what the use case is. You're using an agent-based approach to do that rather than having them tell you the use case. And I'm curious to know, I see people get very excited about that. It really lights people up and helps them understand the promise of what we're trying to build here. And I wonder if you can share, as much as you can share, have you been doing this in real client settings? What are you seeing? What are some of the places where our customers are thinking that, they do want to include AI in the decision-making process? Have we gotten to the point of actually building DIPs? What are you seeing that you can share with us?
Let me give you an analogy, an example. Many, many years ago, in the pre-Siri days, we built this system where you could actually, there was a microphone and you could actually talk to your home entertainment system. And so it took us a while to set it all up as a little showcase in our little office in downtown Mountain View. And one of our advisors, a former chairman of Borland, was the first user. So we gave him, he walked in, we sat him down with the microphone, and we're like, yep, you can say anything you want to your home entertainment system. And he just sat there. And it was so awkward. So I was sitting next to him and I was like, you can say anything, you got the TV set, you got the, satellite system, the lights, the whatever. It took him a good awkward minute of silence, and then he turned to me and said, I don't typically talk to my TV set, so I'm just like, let me gather my thoughts. And that's the analogy that that's we awesome. Ran into when we started going out to clients and talking about AI augmented decision making. The mistake that we made early on was to go to them and say, okay, tell us about the decisions that you want augmented. And, we got the very typical stuff like, yeah, BPO, that, we want to optimize this or that. It was very specific decision making, or it was this confusing of decision making with, just give me the insights, versus the actual decision making. And so that prompted us to go back and think about how do we present this even? And how do we allow the client in their language to understand all the various different places where AI can come in and help them with their decision making. And so what I do on stage these days is exactly that. I have an agent. I don't start with the scoping. I start with the identifying of the opportunity. So I have an opportunity finder agent, and I basically ask the client, you know, what is the name of your company or your division or your department? And let's just type that in. And we type that in, and the agent, being LLM based, does a search on publicly available information. And it also knows about the decision flows and decision processes. And it comes back and says, here are, you know, five different areas. Here's the one we think has the best ROI. And here's how I calculate the ROI. The moment we get into that discourse, the client is talking their own language. It's not about AI gobbledygook or, optimization this or that, you know. And once we get there, then we move on to, okay, so what is the KPI? What are the outcomes that you care about in this particular decision flow? And here are some that the AI is giving you. So we move from one agent to the next, as the agents collaborate with the client in identifying the use case. And we generate some synthetic data. You know, obviously we have to use the data that's running within that client, but we don't have access to that. I don't have access to that on stage. So we generate some data that resembles the data that we think the client will have, or third party data that we can bring in. And using that, we actually take the client all the way to the decisioning interface where they can run what if scenarios. They can get explanations for why the AI thinks they should do something. And it's a very iterative process. We go back, we refine, and so forth. But that's the key, is to get the client to see, what is the art of the possible, and the interface that in the future, once they have the real data plugged in and the training and all that happens, that they would end up using. I think that's super important.
And is this gaining traction already, you know, with our clients? Do we have clients?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really exciting because not only is it gaining traction, the clients start realizing, oh, no, that's not the only one I want to do. There's the other three are interesting too, and let me bring it to this other person. And so we have some clients that have demanded to run the entire agentic system, the development environment that we used as an accelerator, in-house, because now they realize that, you know, as a company, you know, there's no end in decisioning points that they can automate and augment. And right. So they want the entire thing in-house and for us to train them to operate it as this factory that kind of helps them generate decisioning systems.
So I want to stick on, you know, what you've been talking about for a minute, but I actually want to ask you your thoughts about the ethical implications. And, you know, I was reading something over the weekend. It was an opinion piece about, you know, whether the primary focus when we're thinking about AI should be on optimizing for the benefit of individual users or the overall system. Obviously, there are implications of both. Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on this. You know, what do you think the answer is, if there is one answer? And what are the ethical implications of either approach?
Such a tricky question here. Okay, so here's the interesting thing. Do we optimize the system for the system, for the greater good of the whole, right? Mm-hmm. Or do we optimize the system for the individual, right? So is it a mindful system, or is it a persuasive technology, or is it a consensual technology, right? And so there are dials that we're going to actually have to determine along the way to say, what are we optimizing for? Right now, AI is a funky thing in the sense that it's totally opposite from the age of the internet. In the age of the internet, systems were open, they were decentralized, there were many players, costs were coming down. AI is the entire opposite. For whatever reason at the moment, we've got closed systems, right? These are completely centralized by nature. And of course, there's few players and everything costs more, right? And so what we do have to get to a point is, if you think about a 2x2 graph, we have a culture of scarcity on one end, a culture of abundance on the other. We have centralization on the bottom and decentralization on the top. Well, we're centralized scarcity. We've we've got to move to decentralized abundance, right? So that's the first step. So if you believe in, right, individuals having more rights, you're going to design a system where the individuals benefit from the system, not the system is forcing the individuals to conform to their choices. So that's a design question in ethics. The other piece is really, what do we want to do in terms of the control of those systems and in terms of, like, you know, how they make decisions? And so we need checks and balances somewhere. So this is why people say there's some level one ethics for AI. Level one being, hey, algorithms should be transparent, right? Second of all, they should be explainable, understand what's going on. You make decisions with bias, and that's not a bad thing, but unwanted bias may get you into trouble. So if you're discriminating against left-handed people with purple hair, oh, that's bad. We're going to have to actually reverse those decisions and unlearn. And so we have to build the capabilities to unlearn systems, which is not an easy thing to do because you're basically doing untraining and basically trying to unravel all the things. Like, you can't forget a memory, right? There's some things you see you can't unsee, and that's what's going to happen in the system. And then, of course, at some point, we actually have to do enough training to get these systems to the right level of precision that you're happy with. And then we have to figure out, do we want Skynet or not? Which is basically, where do you insert a human in the loop? And so, so those five things are probably, to us, like basic level one ethics that everybody can agree on. And then after that, it's going to be country specific. It's going to go based on, you know, how you're comfortable with something. I'll give you a great example. We do use this all the time. So I'll be upfront. I'm going to offend Canadians, maybe offend people of Eastern European descent and offend people of East Asian descent, right? So autonomous vehicle, yeah, a couple billion people here. Autonomous vehicle hits a dog in Canada. What do you expect happens? Well, the car flags down a human, gets the dog into the back. They rush to the hospital, the veterinary hospital clinic. While they're there, they call the owner, tell them to meet them there. They pick up the tab. And 30 days later, they check in on the human to see if everyone's okay and if the pet's doing fine. That doesn't sound offensive, right? That sounds very Canadian, right? Okay, great. A autonomous vehicle runs over a dog in Eastern Europe. There are no cameras. They run the dog over six more times and leaves. Ooh. Now, if you were to say that to someone, there are people like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. A autonomous vehicle runs over a dog in East Asia. Well, there's lots of cameras. The fine for hitting the dog, if it's killed, is $1,000, right? The medical bill is about $10,000. What's for dinner? Just kidding. So this sounds harsh, right? But if you were to tell this story to people from different parts of the world, they'll just be like, oh yeah, of course, right? And maybe not all the cases, but you get the idea. It's hard to get to those ethics because we look at things very differently. But to take someone else's life is a pretty serious deal. So you draw the line there, right? And to steal from someone, you draw the line, but then some people are like, oh, you're trying to help the poor, you're Robin Hooding it, it could be okay, right? I mean, there's no absolutes. And so I think we're going to have to tune these models to not only the cultural standards, and we also have to tune these models to different types of personalities as well. So this is funny. Like, when people believe, like, there's going to be agents and they're all going to act the same, I'm like, no, we're going to put some personality in this agent. This one's going to be like, this is going to be super talkative and a negotiator, right? This one's going to be very quiet and passive, right? This one's going to be a backstabber. This one's going to be like, and you're going to create all the personas you see in real life are going to happen again. And you're like, oh, this is going to be very interesting how we get to those ethics and how do we get to the randomness that we have with human interactions.
It is interesting. I want to hear your thoughts on this too, Babak, but it is interesting that we accept that lots of different humans are going to train these, and yet somehow we think they would all end up being the same. Right?
Oh yeah, not going to happen. That's totally not going to happen unless you want it to, right? This is the thing, right? You can have very black and white worlds that actually are very hard to distinguish because they all act the same. So,
Babak, I'm love to hear your thoughts too from an ethics perspective.
Yeah, I mean, totally agree with what Ray said. Also, I mean, it does depend on the use case. Mm-hmm. Definitely the ethics of different use cases differ. And, you know, you can think of a system in law enforcement requiring certain capabilities that you wouldn't allow the public to use, for example. So you have to decide. Sometimes it's a false choice. In other words, we believe as humans that we're always optimizing for one thing, but we can have AI optimized for more than one thing at the same time. The example was COVID. Like, it seemed like there's this polarization where part of the world wanted to save lives and part of the world wanted to save the economy. Well, guess what? It's a false choice. You want to do both at the same time. And maybe that's where AI can help you. Same thing with this question of, you know, the whole versus the individual. I mean, that's, you know, can't find any tension more pronounced than that in politics and humanities. But again, that might be a false choice. It's something that we deal with as individuals all the time. Like, it seems like everything that we do that is socially biased is good, and anything that's individually biased, it's bad. But that's really not the case. We're always kind of balancing the two between each other. Yeah. So that's one thing I wanted to mention. There are features that AI has that can come to help us to mitigate some of these issues. But again, to Ray's point, at the end of the day, we can't shirk our responsibilities. Yes. One thing that I keep saying all the time is, up until now, a lot of our laws and institutions and codes of ethics have really been a cop-out when you think about it. What they do is they leave it ambiguous, you know, and defer the definition to the when the instance happens. And then, okay, we'll take this to court and decide whether or not this was a good thing or a bad thing. Mm-hmm. When it comes to AI, we really need to be much more specific than that, right? We need to be able to encode our ethics in non-ambiguous terms as much as possible if we want the AI to be able to autonomously make decisions at certain points. If we can't do that, then to Ray's point, that's where the human comes in. We, you know, mm-hmm. if anything, just to blame them if they get it wrong.
Darn human again.
How do you, I'm curious too, you know, how do you both see this balance of, you know, agency and collaboration between humans and AI systems evolving? You know, when you talk about a plane without a pilot, and I think, gosh, that sounds so terrifying. But, you know, I sat in a Waymo, you know, the last time I was in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and I'm sure 2 years ago, I probably wouldn't have thought I would have done that. So, you know, I think we're all going to get more and more comfortable with the way that these technologies are going to infuse and augment our lives. And I'm curious, what do you see, you know, the balance looking like, you know, by the end of the decade, let's say?
Ooh. You want to take that, Pavarka, first?
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, we've been here before. I mean, you talk about self-driving cars. I mean, we ceded control of our transmission system years ago when cars went from manual to automatic. You don't even think twice. You're sitting in that car and pushing the accelerator and it decides when to change, shift gears. Right. So it's not that we have not relied on autonomous systems to make decisions on our behalf, and we haven't figured out where we need to come in and where not. It's just, it kind of is a little overwhelming with AI because it's so general purpose and there's so many areas where we can actually make use of it. But I think we are, if anything, even more responsible than ever before in deciding those boundaries, deciding where we actually apply this very powerful technology and how we apply it. Mm-hmm. And I think culturally, we will get used to it. I mean, your experience in sitting in a self-driving car, I bet like most people, they sit in and it's really, really exciting for the first 5 minutes. And then it's like, yeah.
That's
whatever,
right.
It's just driving me there and it's fine. Like it goes away. And for those of us, I mean, I live in San Francisco, I take Waymo all the time. And it's just this very ordinary thing. Like these days, getting to a stop intersection with four self-driving cars with no drivers, you know, kind of waiting on each other is just this thing that, you know, is just ordinary, normal. So these things will shift gradually culturally and we will get used to that. So as you can tell, I don't want to predict what happens in 10 years. That's like way, I mean, I don't even know what's going to happen.
It's
in
too soon,
months.
Right? No, it's too far. I just can't figure that. You know, to add to that, I think the way we have to look at this is, we're going to constantly evolve and how we adapt, is an action and reaction to everything we do. And so yeah, the cars are going to drive themselves, but what is the, you know, horizon two, horizon three impact, whether the next level, next order of impact, it means you and I will be living out in the middle of nowhere. We're going to wake up at work, right? I mean, we could live really far out, not have to deal with density issues, which get everybody, you know, antsy and complaining about stuff and traffic. So, you know, you leave your house at 2 a.m, you show up to work at like 5, right? Or, you know, you'll be ready to go, or you can just, you know, sleep your way on your way in, right? And these, you basically walk in a pod and show up at work. So you can see like things like a third order, like impacts of these technologies that will then build on themselves again. And you might actually have less cars because, you know, you just hop into a random pod. It's not even yours. You just get on and you buy a timeshare onto a pod to get into work. And traffic is much lighter because while everyone's doing it, you actually have less cars on the road because these things are floating around. They're just empty systems that are actually picking and dropping people off on demand. So it could actually even be better that way. And so you've got to imagine the world in those type of implications. And you also have to take into account that the population of the world is going to decline in the next 20 years. So we're going to go from like 9 billion to 7 billion back to 5 billion. And we don't have enough people or to do all the work. So that level of automation is going to be around in a way that we can't even imagine today.
You know, just to build on that for a minute, we have been dealing with intelligent beings that autonomously make decisions and hierarchies and get stuff done since the industrial age. It just happens that those autonomous decision-making beings have been humans. So that transition is not something that we're completely unfamiliar with. Culture has to kind of catch up with the fact that they're just simply not humans and they're making decisions. But I think when you look out 10 years, 20 years to Ray's point as we have to rely more and more on these autonomous agents, I think we have a blueprint for how to set those up and work within those kinds of societies.
So, you know, it's so interesting hearing all of the corollaries and all of the ways in which we really are already living in a society that has a lot of autonomous, you know, technology and developments that augment us. And yet, for some reason, there's a lot of fear, you know, as it relates to AI. And, you know, as we wrap up today, I want to get your thoughts on, you know, this year's theme at Davos, collaboration for the intelligent age. And it came from, you know, a conversation that Klaus Schwab had where he basically said that as these technologies are reshaping the world, we're at an inflection point where it's either going to elevate humanity or it's going to fracture humanity, right? There seems to be this feeling, like you said, maybe that's a false choice, but, you know, what are the implications when you think about this notion of collaboration in the intelligent age? What do you think are the implications for decision intelligence and really for everything that we're on the cusp of that we've been talking about today?
I don't know. I think my agent's going to call up a box agent and we're going to figure out when we're going to meet in real life.
At Davos, maybe.
Right? At Davos. We'll be there, right? It is, right? We got to think about human to human to machine, machine to machine, and then back machine to human, right? Mm-hmm. That's the collaboration that's going to occur. And if you've seen movies like Multiplicity, where like, you know, there's multiple versions of you, the syncing process of getting everything back is really going to be the hard part. Like, you know, you sent an agent out to do something and they acted on your behalf, but you have no idea what they did. Right. So you're going to have to know and sync back to understand what decisions were made and what implications are there. It's going to be a pretty cool problem to solve. Right. I don't think it's not impossible. I think it's just actually a very cool problem to solve with that level of collaboration. We also have to understand that in that process of collaboration, the different personalities are going to impact how you make decisions. Like today we do like a Myers-Briggs test. Maybe we have like robots that have an even distribution of ENTJs or IFT, you know, like IFTPs, right? It'd be interesting, right? And so that's really what it is. Like we self-select on teams already, right? And the different agents and bots and that collaboration is going to self-select. And you might be like, oh, we're missing one of these, right? And so we insert one of them into the process so that we get a different point of view or perspective. So it's going to work like that, but I don't think it's going to be that apparent that we're doing that.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think it also comes down to us, what future has in store for us with this level of autonomy and intelligence at our disposal comes down to how we choose to make use of these systems as humans. At the end of the day, we're responsible for the future that we envision and the future that we build. I get this question a lot about, oh, aren't you afraid that AI will do this, AI will do that? And I always know that that question has less to do with AI and more to do with humans using AI. And so I think that it bringing this, I mean, the question that Klaus brought up, is a really, really important question that humanity needs to consider, because we're going to build these systems. And, you know, whether they collaborate or compete and what the outcome is going to be is really up to how we set them up.
Oh, yeah.
What a great last word. Ray and Babak, it's such a thrill to talk to both of you always. Thank you so much for being on Stay Cognizant today, and look forward to continued conversations in 2025 with both of you.
Thank you.
Right. Hey, thanks a lot for having us.